Welcome to the third episode of the sixth season of the Ubuntu UK podcast. It's Wednesday the 13th of March, and in this episode we're going to discuss what's been in the news. We'll also be talking about the latest happenings in the Ubuntu community. If you're listening live, you can send us messages using the chat facility on the website or just in the plain old IRC channel if that's what you've got. Joining me this week is Laura.
Hello.
And Mark.
Hello.
And Alan.
Good evening.
And I completely failed to mention that my name is Tony. So we're set for an interesting roundup of news this evening.
Yes.
All the latest stuff. There's been a lot going on, so I guess we better crack on with it.
Sounds like a fun-packed show.
And we've got some news. Microsoft has been fined again.
What for this time?
Same as before.
Oh, that's a bit harsh, isn't it?
This is the browser choice thing.
Yeah. I feel like this has been going on forever. But apparently, it worked in Windows 7. And then when they released a fix pack, somebody removed it.
It was a technical error.
A technical error.
Oops.
Yeah.
Or a cunning idea. Mm. Or a technical error.
Mm. It's funny how that should coincide with, haven't they got a new browser out? And they're just doing loads of marketing on the telly about their new browser. Yeah, funny that.
Technical error.
Yeah, technical error.
Yeah.
Not a marketing error.
People weren't prompted to choose from Internet Explorer or Firefox or Chrome or Opera or Safari or
Maxathon.
What? I think so.
It's a weird browser.
Is that on the list?
Yeah.
Maxathon.
How do you have to scroll really far?
No, it's Firefox, then Maxathon, then Opera, then Chrome.
It's all random.
Maybe it's not the same. Oh, okay. I just thought
it was like right over on the. You have to have a look at a very.
There's only about five or six, and maybe it picks like some of the less popular ones at random.
Not anymore.
Mm. I think it's back in now.
Oh.
I think they fixed the EC said, "Oi, where's it gone?"
How much did they get fined?
Oh.
561 million euros.
Right. And we still have a debt problem in Europe, right? After that?
Well, can we just get them to pay it off?
Yeah.
Could they have just bought Greece?
Probably.
Okay. Well, interesting to know that you're staying on Microsoft's case, I guess.
Yeah.
Speaking of the EU, they're also blocking emails from citizens.
Yeah, not such a good story for the EU.
That's nice of them.
Yeah, apparently Christian Engstrom, MEP for the Pirate Party, discovered that emails sent to him in response to an upcoming vote to prevent all forms of pornography in the media were being blocked.
Right, so is this over-aggressive spam filtering, or is there something more to
it than that? Well, this was actually, like, there was a vote on this resolution, or I don't know the proper legal term for it. And you know, people were like, right, well, let's all object to this and tell our MEPs that we object to this. So they all sent them emails saying, you know, we don't like this very much. And then the MEP said, oh, well, our emails are being flooded with this, so can you block it, please, to their IT department?
Who did?
And so they did.
Wow. Our constituents are speaking to us. Please stop that.
Yes.
Less of that, please.
It's disturbing my afternoon nap. But I often wonder about the effectiveness of some of these sort of get in touch with them type systems. Mm. And I get the emails from Open Rights Group and 38 Degrees and things like that. And they sort of say, oh, email your MP or MEP about this issue or the other issue. And sometimes I do, and sometimes I don't get around to it.
Do you ever get a reply?
Yes.
Sometimes, but it's usually a postal reply.
I've never had any reply from my MP.
Oh, we usually do.
I can't remember which issue it was.
Gerald Howarth.
Name and shame.
Howarth.
There was one issue where I emailed several candidates about something, and I think three of them got back to me, but the one who currently held the position didn't.
Hmm. I once made the mistake of doing that where they sent it to like three or four different people who were involved to do with like MEP. I can't remember what it was about even. But now I get random newsletters from various MEPs that I didn't know existed. Lucky apparently you, they're you. My MEP.
I once emailed a US senator about something I wasn't happy about in the US. And I said, look, I realise I'm
not a constituent.
Somewhere outside your constituency boundary. But he wrote me a fairly lengthy reply, and it was a personal one. It wasn't like a boilerplate. Like,
good.
Wow.
I thought, wow, if some guy in a foreign country can manage that, why can't Gerald Howard?
My mum and dad's claim to fame is that Jack Straw left a voicemail on their answer phone.
To be fair, yeah.
Did they burn it?
No, they kept it. He was their local MP. Ah. He's a pretty good local MP.
I've actually personally written to my MPs when I lived in Southampton. So that I like lived in two different wards, so two different MPs, and they
did you play them off against each other?
No, they were both from the same party.
Oh.
But they would always like forward my comments onto the minister concerned and like forward me the reply back. So
was the minister concerned? Was his email address abuse@?
But this wasn't through a one of those automated things. This was me, you know, seeing the issue and then going to the MP's website and emailing them directly rather than doing it through a form letter. So I think that probably has more impact than the same copy and paste thing.
Well, they do say not to just use the form letter, even though they give it to you. Yeah, no.
I mean, on a purely practical basis, I can sympathise. If you have 10,000 emails land in your inbox, that's quite a good way of stopping you from being productive, getting through your email.
Surely they hire people to do that.
They do. Well, they don't do it themselves.
Well, that's it. I assume they do, but you never...
EU costs so much money. It's all those people sitting there reading our
emails. Reading form emails. I mean, as somebody who once accidentally dumped 10,000 emails into my inbox by fixing a server and letting it send all the outgoing email to me, I know that was a very unproductive morning.
I don't know why you were looking at me.
Well, because Tony is. That's why.
He's just looking at me because I know who it was.
Okay, there's good news for Linux gamers, of them.
Tony and Mark. Tony, Alan.
Here we go.
Tony.
Alan.
So just a month after its official release on the platform, Linux now represents about 2% of Steam usage. So this is Steam, the kind of games platform available for Linux now.
Yes.
And 2% of that is now Linux.
That's a massive amount, is it?
Well,
not proportionally, but
I mean, if you compare it to, you know, people would probably say, oh, you know, Mac is now probably a fairly established gaming platform.
Yeah.
Mac has about 3% of market share on Steam, and they've had Steam for 3 years, whereas we've had it officially for 2 months.
Okay.
Isn't that because Mac users are busy working?
Yeah,
while we're loafing around,
busy polishing their orange sunglasses.
Yeah,
exactly. And we're
attending cocktail
games.
Parties and the like.
Yeah.
So, why does Linux appeal more to gamers than Mac?
More geeks.
Or why do games appeal more to Linux users than Mac users? Possibly. Or maybe people who can afford a Mac can also afford a separate machine to play games on.
And they all play Angry Birds anyway.
Well, modern Macs aren't exactly gamer machines. If you're a hardcore gamer, you want something that... Yeah, probably you want a desktop machine for a start. You don't want a laptop.
That's true.
You can buy laptops which are desktop replacement style, you know, really heavy, have a fairly decent video card, but they're still... They're pretty expensive for what they are. You can't upgrade them very easily, whereas, you know, a real hardcore gamer will want to put... max out the RAM, put a decent video card in, or maybe multiple video cards, a decent power supply, loads of extra cooling, and maybe upgrade each of those components over the lifetime of the machine.
But then again, are you saying that the majority of Steam users are those kind of people?
No, I'm saying gamers, high-end gamers.
Yes.
Because Tony was asking, do gamers prefer Linux over Mac?
Oh, okay. Gamers in general, yes.
Yeah,
okay.
And I think high-end gamers not necessarily choose Linux over Mac, but choose
it's
a hardware platform that doesn't natively support Mac OS X.
Yes, because
you can tweak it.
Yeah, and, you know. But also, you know, people are playing games on non-Steam as well, on Apple platforms. So they're not just, it's not just on an Apple machine you would be using Steam or nothing at all. You might also be playing, you know, games on phone or tablet.
Okay. So there's also been another Humble Bundle released in the last few days.
Yes.
Yes, and so that's got games for Windows, Mac, Linux and Android.
Is that the first one that does Android?
No.
That's the fifth.
The fifth? Wow. Really?
Mm-hmm. So what percentage has Android got?
Oh, does it have that as a stack?
They don't separate that. They only have Linux, Windows, Mac.
Because you can't. Well, I suppose you could buy it on Android, but you don't.
You can. They've got their own app.
Can you buy through the app?
I think so.
I thought that was just for downloading games.
I might actually just link you to the site, and then you pay for it by PayPal or whatever. Mm.
But there's a very fun game called Super Hexagon.
When you say fun, you mean insanely hard.
I've got past the first level.
It's quite difficult.
I haven't got past
To get past the first level, you have to last for 60 seconds.
It is like the simplest looking game ever, but it's so hard.
What do you have to do?
So there's a hexagon in the middle of the screen,
and you're a little
triangle that's sort of orbiting the hexagon.
Is this like Asteroids?
No. It looks quite a bit like Asteroids.
Just for reference, Tony believes all games are either like Pac-Man or like Asteroids or like Space Invaders. If they are not like those three games, then they're completely out of his realm.
So
of
it's like Asteroids.
Yeah.
Except instead of the asteroids floating around, they're all coming directly towards you very quickly.
But
and you
blind.
Have to get out of their way. You don't get to shoot.
It's like Pac-Man
right.
if all the ghosts were hexagon shaped and coming towards you from all around you, and you have to steer left and right to get away from them.
You can do is steer left and right like an Asteroids, but you don't turn pink like in Space Invaders.
Yes, like Space Invaders. But you don't shoot.
No.
And the aliens look like hexagons.
It's like Pong, but in a circle.
Is it like a 2D scroller?
It does look a lot like Pong,
actually.
Where
you can only move left
and
right.
Yes, it is. It's like a 2D scroller, but instead of going left and right, you go into the screen.
That's like a third dimension.
It's like Asteroids.
Yeah, there is a third
dimension. They have these now.
There is a third dimension.
Yeah.
It's nothing like Manic Miner.
Well, all that talk of games has got me very excited. And I'm going to check it out.
We'll have a cup of tea later, and you can have a play of Super Hexagon.
Okay, that sounds good. Yes. But let's talk about patents now.
Okay.
Yes, let's.
Well, Google and MPEG-LA, who are the people who own lots of media patents for things like H.264 and the like, and MPEG, have agreed on a license for WebM. So that means that Google is now has the license to use any MPEG-LA-owned patents which WebM infringes on, and it's allowed to sub-license them on a royalty-free basis to anyone and everyone, and it's allowed to use them in a next-generation VP8 WebM successor.
So, technical question.
Yes.
What's WebM?
WebM is... You're a video man!
I know, I'm asking on behalf of
the listeners.
He's being dumb.
Okay. For the benefit of the tape, WebM is a...
container, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a container format, which is... So like OGG is a container format which can contain video and audio. WebM is a container format which can contain VP8 encoded video, which is a codec owned by Google, which is open source.
But they bought VP8, didn't they?
And they bought the company that produced VP8, Onto. Yes.
And when they bought that, did they know at the time that it was potentially infringing patents owned or, you know, licensable by the MPEG-LA?
I don't know. They reckoned it wasn't, and they told everyone it wasn't, and then...
Well, they thought it was royal. It was, we're royalty-free, you know.
Basically, yes.
See, this is the same thing that that we've heard all the time about OGG.
Yes.
Vorbis and Fiora,
yes.
Is that there's no problem with them. Mm. Is it just that there is a problem with them in the same way that there is a problem with VP8? It's just that VP8 has Google behind it, so there's a good reason for the MPEG-LA to go after them and get a cross-license deal or to get them to pay them money. Whereas there's no reason for MPEG-LA to go after Ziff, who make OGG and Vorbis, because there's no monetary... benefit to be gained from doing that. All they could ever do is just squash OGG and stop it ever being used.
Yeah.
Whereas VP8, there's actually a giant company with big buckets of money behind the codec, and that's the reason why MPEG-LA went for them. And arguably, all of the open source codecs infringe something somewhere, but none of them have a giant company with buckets of money behind
them. But surely if they want to get buckets of money from the giant company with buckets of money, then they would... want to get some sort of royalty from them rather than striking a one-off agreement that then allows them to proliferate this code.
But the thing is, we don't know what those discussions were and what agreements were come up with between Google and MPEG, do we?
Well, the agreement that's been announced is that Google can sub-license everything on a royalty-free basis.
Wow.
Okay.
Well, I'm surprised.
There are lots of questions that throws up around, you know,
yeah. Well, this is when I read this, I thought, well, what's the benefit to MPEG-LA of doing this? So I had a chat with our guy at work who's like our IP and licensing man, and he suggested a few things that I hadn't thought of, like the fact that if MPEG-LA had formed the patent pool, which they were planning to, of like companies who they have members with, and they say, oh, that infringes our patent, so we'll throw our patent into the pool. If they then took Google to court, who have a lot of money and a lot of lawyers, Google's defences would first be, no, we don't infringe. And if they then lost that argument, they would say, well, those patents aren't valid. And if they then won any of those arguments, that would screw MPEG-LA over quite severely, because their whole purpose would be completely torn apart.
Their business model, yeah. Right, okay.
Right, okay. Well,
then, you know, also, what about H.264? Surely we already use H.264. Well, are Google just going to...
This is for the other thing. Now that Mozilla have said, right, well, we're going to support H.264 because that's what everyone's using, and Google haven't taken it out of Chrome, so, you know, everyone's just using H.264, we might as well support it. Now WebM is less of a target for getting some sort of ongoing license fee from, and they're getting the money from H.264, so WebM's not something for them to worry about.
Potentially, now that we've got, like, embedded in the browser, we could have VP8 decoding in the browser.
Yeah.
By default in all the browsers, and the silicon vendors in the next generation could put VP8 decoding in their silicon.
VP9, because they've also got patent license for the next generation.
Okay. So this isn't going to really affect anyone, like, today or this year?
Probably not.
No. Okay.
Well, there we go. Okay, well, we have lots of community news to talk about, so I think we should probably get on with that.
All right.
The Ubuntu podcast needs you. Yes, you. If you hear something that pleases, puzzles, or piques you, tweet us at UUPC or email podcast@ubuntu-uk.org. You can also talk to us on the telephone, Skype, Facebook, and Google+. Find links to all these places on our website, podcast.ubuntu-uk.org. And remember, if we don't hear from you, we might not have enough content, and that can only mean one thing: more quizzes.
It's time for community news, brackets including events.
Catchy.
Go.
I'm glad that we've got a better name for it this season. And Stormfly, the bootable Linux desktop on a USB drive, has reached its Kickstarter funding goal.
Amazingly.
That's good for them, isn't it?
$120,000 they raised. They were aiming for $100,000.
Wow.
They've got about 1,100 backers. And, they've raised $120,000.
To make a load of USB sticks using Ubuntu.
Yeah, to basically put Ubuntu on a bunch of USB sticks.
They're bracelets. They're not just any USB sticks.
Oh, they're cool, those.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, when you plug the...
You plug the USB thing in and it makes a bracelet, and then you don't have to carry it around.
Is it worth about 50 quid?
No.
There you go.
Because that's what people have been.
I just can't fathom this. I mean, okay, it's good in that they're bringing, you know, a product to market which has Ubuntu on it, although they don't really say much about the fact that it's got Ubuntu on it. But it just seems like a USB stick, a bootable USB stick.
Yeah, no, it's cool to have a USB stick you can put around your wrist and carry around quite easily. Why are you carrying an operating system wrong like that?
It's so that you can use someone else's computer. You know, when you go to Nana and Grandpa's house, you don't have to take your computer with you, or when you're at work.
You have to use their Windows 95 machine.
Yeah, exactly. You can just boot your own machine.
Don't be silly. A Windows 95 machine can't run Unity.
Or you could go around to a friend's house and use theirs. Or, go into work and, you know. Although I would question whether most organisations would allow you to boot off a random operating system and connect to their network. They probably wouldn't know. It just seems a bit weird, but hey ho, good luck to them.
Cool.
Yeah, if you're one of the people who stumped up for it, then let us know why. What appealed about it?
Why? Also, HP have launched an all-in-one PC running Ubuntu, which has gone on sale in the UK for £349.
Cool.
It's brilliant.
Well, it's a computer running Ubuntu out of the box that you can buy today on HP's website.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a good thing.
It's the pretty one.
It's an all-in-one. Yeah, one that, you know, you might have in a kitchen or a playroom or, you know, kids' room or something like that.
It's really all-in-one.
Why not?
Keyboard separate.
All-in-one means the screen and the computer.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, two-in-one. Plus keyboard. And
wow. See, I'd say a laptop was all-in-one, but, you know.
Yeah.
Well, the power cable isn't.
They have, like, whenever I look at one of these things where someone started selling Ubuntu, there's always, like, the sort of technical specification for the machine. They've not quite got it right in that it's, like, it says, you know, operating system, no operating system installed, brackets Ubuntu or something like that.
Or Microsoft Ubuntu 1204 or something. Yeah,
there's funny mistakes on the Dell one as well.
Yeah.
Or like something to do with the version of, there's no Office installed, and then above it says Ubuntu included LibreOffice.
Hmm. Part of the problem is all these websites were always only ever designed to sell computers that run Windows.
Yeah.
And when you try and crowbar a product in there that doesn't fit their database setup, they have to make concessions. There's one on the Dell website, one of the Dell's ships with Ubuntu. It says no Office installed.
Yes.
And yeah.
I think that's what I think.
So yeah, we've passed that feedback back and I'm sure they'll fix it.
So this is the HP Pavilion 20, and a quick rundown of the specs show that it's got 1.4 gig dual core CPU, 4 gig of RAM, 500 gig spinning Rust hard disk, and a 20-inch HD widescreen display.
Ooh.
So it's not the most powerful machine in the world. Mm-hmm. It's sort of a netbook spec with a
what's a netbook?
With a big screen. Things we used to play with.
Before you got your Nexuses.
I remember those from season one.
Yes.
So, when I were a lad, all this was netbooks.
So yeah, not the most powerful machine in the world, but perfectly good for browsing the web and Facebook and a few apps here and there.
I think it's a test. I think HP are clearly doing a test of one product in one region to see, you know, how it's going to go. And if people actually buy it, then you might see more of them in the HP store.
So go out and buy them now.
Yeah, so buy them. Buy them now.
This week has seen a lot of controversy in the Ubuntu community.
Why is that?
Well, there's been lots of reasons. One of the reasons has been the announcement of a rolling release.
The
idea of a rolling release.
Well, Rick sent a mail to the Ubuntu Devil List, making a proposal for discussion.
If it was an announcement, that's the developer list, not the devil.
Yes, not devils, devel. And it was all about having a discussion. And he put up an argument for, you know, going rolling release and doing monthly releases. And there was an awful lot of discussion about it. And some people presumed that it was a foregone conclusion, which is understandable given we have a past history of saying,
foregone conclusions.
Exactly. We're thinking of doing this. There, we've done it.
And the effect of this was that people thought that all of the hard work they put into the next release was therefore completely moot because it was being dropped and replaced with a rolling release schedule.
Yeah, and given we did all that planning at the last UDS and we have sprints and that aiming for end of April as 1304, I can see a valid argument why people would say, well, you know, you've basically just tipped up the table with all our work on it.
What's a rolling release?
So the idea behind a rolling release, there's lots of options, and Rick has, and others on that list, have put forward suggestions. But the general plan is that you have a release of Ubuntu which isn't date stamped and fixed at a certain point in time and then doesn't get new versions of software, which is what we currently have. So 1204, for example, won't get a very new version of LibreOffice. It'll get bug fixes, it'll get security updates, but it won't get like LibreOffice 4 or 5 or anything like that.
Okay.
With a rolling release, you can get new stuff all the time, and you get new stuff daily, weekly, and so on.
So distributions like Arch or Debian Unstable.
Debian Testing, really. Yeah. They're all arguably rolling because they're constantly being updated. You can't necessarily say 1204 in the same way that you can say 1204 ships with LibreOffice 3.x. You know, if you say Ubuntu rolling release, whatever name it's got, let's call it Raring Ringtail.
The rolling roadhog.
Yes, the rolling roadhog release, you can't exactly say it has this version of LibreOffice. It's a moving target.
Oh, I see.
It had that version of LibreOffice last week, but this week, ta-da, new version. And so, and all of it can change, like Unity, all the way down through to the kernel, everything can change.
What's the benefit of that? sounds so complicated to support.
Well, one of the it's actually complicated for us to support normal releases.
Okay.
Because at the moment we have like 10.04, 12.04, 12.10, and when a security update comes out, we have to put that through the whole landscape of all those releases. So supporting them is an expensive proposition, but also actually spinning out a release is expensive because we basically wind up work on that release and we like stop working on it and nothing happens for a while. There's a period where we're not developing new stuff. We're busy getting the release out.
Yeah.
We could maybe optimize that and make that a bit better and make it faster and leaner.
Hmm.
But it does slow us down having these releases all the time.
So you just have one ongoing release
and
for
LTS.
2 years, yeah.
An LTS that's getting security updates and patches.
And nothing more.
And nothing more.
And then everybody else gets just this continuous thing until the next LTS?
That's a proposal, but there have been loads of other proposals as well, like having a rolling release and monthly releases as well. But how long do you support those monthly releases for? At least with a monthly release, you can say, you know, I'm running 1304 or 1305, and you know what's in 1305. Whereas if you're running the rolling release that's constantly changing, it's more of a moving target. You know what I mean?
It's when did I last update?
Exactly. So, but from the support perspective, one argument is actually a rolling release is easier because when someone says, "Oh, something's broken and this isn't working," the first question you ask is, "Are you up to date?"
Yeah.
You know.
So is this the only thing that's upset people?
No,
it must be the only thing.
No, there's always lots of things. And there's also been an announcement about something called Mia, which
Space
is
Station.
Which is to replace something called Wayland.
No, that's not true.
To replace something called X?
Bits of it, yes.
Okay,
to replace bits of X, bits of Compiz, and so on.
So Canonical have decided to do away with the legacy graphics stack, the thing that actually makes pictures appear on the screen.
I think everyone has decided to get rid of the legacy X stack.
But everyone else is replacing it with something called Wayland.
Everyone else is pinning their hopes on Wayland.
And Canonical have decided to write their own.
Yes.
Called Mia.
Yes.
Rather than use what everybody else is using. Yeah.
Okay.
What some people are using, yes.
So who's using Wayland?
No one yet.
Well, I think it is actually shipping on a couple of products. I think Tizen might be using it. Tizen's a mobile phone platform.
Okay.
Consortium, Intel, Samsung, maybe some others.
This is the child of Mego.
Oh, yeah.
Whatever. That thing. They might be using Wayland. I think some others. And just today or yesterday, GNOME pinned their flag up and said, yeah, we're going to use Wayland. We're going to, you know,
work. Do you think that was in response to Canonical's announcement?
Just to be contrary.
Not just to be contrary, just to get it a line in the sand and say, look, this is the direction we're going, because people keep asking the questions, like, what about KDE? What about GNOME? What are they going to do?
Yeah.
And so it makes total sense for them to make a big, you know, splash to say, look, this is what we're going to do.
Yeah.
So that everyone knows where they are.
So this was another announcement from Canonical about the decision, and it got people annoyed because it felt like another fait accompli that was delivered. The decision had been made. This is what Ubuntu is going to do.
Yeah.
If you don't like it, well, it's open source software.
I know they've been deliberating about this for a long time. You know, this is Mark said in a blog post back in 2010, I think, that, you know, in the future we will ship Ubuntu with Wayland and Unity will run on Wayland. And everyone kind of took that to mean we will run Unity on Wayland, you know.
Funny.
Yeah.
Mad fools. But things have changed. And at no point over the 2 years, as Mark said, actually, we're rethinking that whole Wayland thing. And at no point have we... Yeah, we've discussed Wayland on the various mailing lists, but we've never actually come out and said, hey, we're looking at other options. And it was only over the last month or two that it started to stir when, you know, people were asking various questions about... Yeah, what are you going to do with the phone? Because you're obviously not going to run X on the phone and the tablet. What are you
now that this has come out, it actually, the whole thing makes a lot more sense to me in terms of, especially in terms of the device convergence. You have one display server system
stack,
on everything,
yeah.
Display stack on everything, and then you just have X compatibility on the desktop to run all the desktop apps.
Yeah.
That makes perfect sense to me.
It does, but you know, unfortunately, the way the announcement was handled was suboptimal.
Yeah. Yes. So it may or may not be the correct technical decision, but there are a lot of people in the community who feel they no longer have a say in the way that Ubuntu's going, which is sad.
Well, some of them didn't anyway.
Yes, you know, this is true. Some
guy sat at home and he's using Mythbuntu on his TV and he's using Ubuntu on his laptop and he's happy doing those things. Does he need to have a say in whether we're going to ship Wayland or Mir or whatever other display server? You know, some people who are really entrenched in the community and are really, you know, contributing deeply to the product, then yeah, I can understand how some of them could be a bit put out. But you know, it doesn't mean that we have to take input from absolutely every single person who's ever held an Ubuntu CD, to be fair.
Well, there we go.
We'll be talking more about this in the next episode, will we not?
Yeah. We will. We're going to speak to John O'Bacon, the community manager from Canonical. Laura, what's up next?
Sorry, I was just looking at AIC. the virtual UDS happens.
Ooh. Yes. What's all that about, Mr. UDS attender?
Yeah.
The first virtual UDS, no longer physical.
So usually UDSs are 5 days, or the last one was 4 days, with 600 plus people attending a physical location on planet Earth and going into rooms and discussing and planning for the next release of Ubuntu. And
did you miss the camaraderie and the smell of your fellow Ubuntu developers?
No.
Free t-shirts.
And so we did a virtual one, which is all happening on Google Hangouts and IRC and Etherpad and using the internet to collaborate rather than flying people and increasing our carbon footprint to get people places.
Fair enough.
And spending lots of money.
But whether it worked or not, I don't know. We're evaluating that. I just got an email with a survey asking, you know.
That's quite good.
Yeah. Asking for feedback. See, we do ask for feedback.
From the employees.
No, I think that went to everyone who attended. Okay. I think.
Cool. Well, it might do now, anyway.
And Ubuntu GNOME Remix has been renamed Ubuntu GNOME as it becomes a recognised flavour along with Kubuntu, Zubuntu and others.
Cool.
Others like Mythbuntu and...
Ubuntu Studio.
Lubuntu.
Edubuntu.
Yes, all those others. All of those flavors. So they're called flavors, not derivatives. Yeah. They're flavors,
which means they get to the benefit of like the canonical build infrastructure and stuff.
They're built on our infrastructure, yeah.
Which is quite cool.
And so, they're going to have to force
their own QA as well.
They're going to have to force their own graphics stack into run the GNOME application.
Well, this was one of the first questions that came up when they when they did this announcement. Was hang on, if GNOME are going to use Wayland, well, we're just going to have to make sure all that works.
Yeah. You
know? So if you
have Wayland packaged for Ubuntu,
but it already is. It's in the repository.
Oh, there you go. Yeah. No problem.
So we have three events to tell you about, and the first one of which is Alan.
Is it? Is it Alan?
It's not Alan.
Okay. That would be Open Source Junction.
Yeah.
Where open source hardware meets open source software. And it's on the 14th to the 15th of March. That's tomorrow.
That's tomorrow.
Oh, gosh, I better get my ticket now. Where can I get it? osj4.eventbrite.co.uk. And it's at Trinity College in Oxford. Do we know anyone there?
No.
We don't know anyone there. We know someone here.
This might be something to do with me.
Cool.
As I mentioned on the last show. So basically it's probably a bit too late to register, but if you are listening now and you want to come, then you can register. You just won't get a free lunch.
Well, maybe you can tell us about it in a future episode in 3 weeks' time.
Yes.
There are 10 hours and 55 minutes left to buy a standard ticket.
Cool. As you're listening live.
That's like, what, really?
Yeah.
By the morning. Oh, okay then. Yeah. I'm not very good with Eventbrite.
Next week, there's a talk about making use of OpenStreetMap data by Nick Whiteleg. That's at Southampton Solent University. So if you're into OpenStreetMap and mapping, get along there and find out how you can find out where all the postboxes are.
He was my supervisor.
Cool. And it's a BCS event, so I think you have to register, do you?
Yes, we'll put a link in the show notes, but it's free, so you can just go along.
And finally...
Eggum Raspberry Pi Jam. I love that. On the 14th of April, and the registration is required, but it's free. And last time they had TARDIS weather balloons, home automation, and big tracks.
Cool. Yes.
Excellent.
Sounds like an interesting event. So get yourself along there, and we'll put a link to the Eventbrite page in the show notes. that's all for this episode, and you can join us next time when we'll be speaking to the internet's John O'Bacon, the Ubuntu community manager, about all of the controversy that's been happening in the Ubuntu community in the last week or so. We're going over your feedback and having some gooey love. Let's hope Alan's throat is still sore so he can say that in a very Barry White manner.
Yeah.
I'm glad that learned mine.
Bye bye.